All right, good morning, church. It is great to be here again, I'm so thankful for Pastor Odell sharing that story. Just to let you know that I have been here before a few times, once, and if you include last night for the Saturate Conference, that makes a few. So this morning, I'm going to ask you to turn with me in your Bibles to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, and as you turn there, let me tell you just a little briefly about who I am and what I would like to see accomplished today. Again, my name is Andy Geisman, and I'm the executive director of an organization called Addison's Walk Institute for Christian Studies, and I do believe that there is an insert in your bulletin that will explain that. All you need to know about that at this point is that I am a missionary to college students. I'm a missionary to college students in a little non-traditional way. Our organization is not a club, so we are not sanctioned or owned or operated in any way by any university. We're a little bit under the radar, but our goal is to engage the academic community at the crossroads of faith, reason, and culture, to reintroduce the orthodox truth claims of Christianity to the table of ideas at the university, and to see lives changed by Jesus Christ. That is primarily what we do. And if you come back tonight, if I can try to woo you to come back tonight, I will share the whole story, because it's kind of amazing that a guy who grew up in a Christian school, went to Bible college and seminary, is teaching at secular universities in philosophy, of all things. Yeah, I didn't think that was going to happen either. So I'd love to tell you about that story and how that happened and share my testimony with you tonight. But my in with students is that I am a philosophy prof. I teach 12 credits, 4 different classes, 2 intro to philosophy courses and 2 ethics courses at 2 Catholic universities. And I do have many, many students who do not identify as Catholic or Christian, who identify as nothing or as militant atheist, if you will. So there's a lot of that going on. So I am a missionary to what is an unreached people group, and I come to you as such. So as a missionary, you might would expect a missionary to go to some of the a little more typical missionary passages. Hear my send me, the fields are white unto a harvest, you'll be my witnesses, all appropriate, excellent things. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to preach from Acts 17 this morning, which I don't know if you've ever had a missionary kind of give their, this is who I am and what I want to do from Acts 17. If so, that's weird. If not, great. This will be new. And I love sharing some things with you. So what we need to understand here about Acts 17 as we begin to get into this text is that if we could sit down and have a conversation with the Apostle Paul, he would talk to us about the difference between necessary and sufficient conditions to engage in ministry. Now, these are nerdo philosophy words that I use. I'll explain all these to you as we go. But he would understand, and Paul was classically trained, so he would understand the difference between necessary and sufficient conditions. If you brought any of your missionaries here and you were to say, what is it that you need? What do you need to minister? And so they might say, well, we need your financial support. I understand that. All missionaries need financial support. Or you may have a missionary that says, oh, we're building a school or a hospital or a shelter for children and women. And so we need steel, we need material, we need concrete. We need the things that we could use to build that. You say, okay, those are the necessary items for ministry. But then if you were to ask that missionary, who's actually getting it done, and you just say, well, is it enough just for us to give you money? Or is it enough just for us to provide material for you to do those things? They would say, no, they're necessary, but if they just sit in a bank account, if money just sits in a bank account, not used for the purposes of engaging people for the cause of Jesus Christ, that doesn't help. Or if you buy tons of steel and it's in a pole barn somewhere on the mission field on the African continent, it's not going to build itself, right? If it does, run, because steel shouldn't be able to do that. So they would be able to tell you the difference that one is necessary, but it's not sufficient. Something has to happen for those things to be used in order for the ministry to take place. So one is necessary, the other is sufficient. I could talk to you about how me standing before you, there are some necessary causes for me to be able to stand here today. I have to have relatively good balance. My heart has to be pumping. I have to be exchanging carbon dioxide with oxygen. There are some chemical and electrical processes going on in my body all at once, but not one of them is sufficient for me to be standing here before you. They are all working together as necessary, and then there's some other systems like my soul and spirit that are part of the necessary systems that give me sufficiency to stand before you. So Paul understands the sufficiency of engaging with a culture, and there's three sufficient strategies that he's going to use to engage this secular culture, which is a university town in ancient Greece. Now, what I want to do this morning is I'm going to spend, and thankfully, Acts 16 through the end of the chapter is broken up nicely into three sections, and we preachers love that because it's almost like the 11th commandment, thou shalt preach messages with 3 points, right? So we kind of like that. So that works out nicely. excuse me. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend a lot of time on the first section. And there are some words there that we might tend to skip over in 21st century North American Christendom, because there could be some things there that we'd see and say, ah, that has nothing to do with us. That's old, dead guys. That has nothing to do with me. Just tell me what I need to do or I need to know. Let's just get on with it. Kind of like those times when you're doing your Bible reading and you get to the list of stuff that Ezra needs to build or a list of genealogies. I don't care about this list of names, and I can't pronounce half of them anyway. Are you serious? Is this for real? And so sometimes we just want to move on. So we're going to spend a lot of time on the first section, and then we're going to pick up some steam, a lot of it, as we move through, because it becomes far more familiar. So let's go to Acts 17, and let me read the first section for you. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, and the them are Timothy and Silas, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day, and those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So, here's the first sufficient cause that Paul wants us to think through. Or actually, Luke, as he's writing this, wants us to think through regarding Paul, is that he has understanding. He has understanding. You probably would agree with me rather readily that if we're going to engage in any kind of effective, sufficient ministry with any group of people, whether it be domestically or foreignly, it would be a good idea to understand the culture into which we're ministering and understand the people to whom we are talking to about Jesus Christ, right? Would that not make sense? Yes, great. Okay, we're still friends? Okay, I can't see you. My retinas are seared by the light, so I think... All right, so there's some understanding. So let's talk about the understanding Paul had. Now, we're going to slow this way down, right? We're going to slow the playback down because I want to walk carefully through this and talk to you about some ideas, some things that I talk about in the classroom. I'm a philosophy teacher. It gives me my access to my students, and I want you to be able to understand some things that they do as well. So let's talk about what Paul understands. First of all, Paul knew at their core, everyone is religious. Paul knew at their core, everyone is religious. And this is going to be very evident in the second section. But it says that as he's waiting for them in the Greek city of Athens, he's greatly distressed to see that the city is full of idols. Let me explain Athens to you a little bit. Athens, if we were to try to understand Athens in a modern context, Athens would not really have a church street. You know how a lot of towns, Americana towns, have a church street? And what do we find on church street? We find churches, right? They all kind of get crammed into one place. In Scranton, we have Drinker Street. And you can just guess what's there, and that's Billy Sunday's doing. But we have Drinker Street in Scranton. So we are not the typical Americana town. We have a church street, but we have more bars than churches. That's a whole other story. So Athens wouldn't really have a church street. Now, from your reading and our observation of Acts 17 and the verses that I read, was there a church in Athens? Was there a church in Athens, yes or no? No. If there was, Paul didn't go there, right? He went to the synagogue, he talked to the God-fearing Greeks, and he went to the marketplace. I'll explain the marketplace here in a little bit. So there is no church, right? So there is no church street. And if we could just do a comparison, just to try to understand religious thought, if we were to think that there was a temple street in Athens, that wouldn't be true either. The entire city is built to be a monument, a lasting monument to their patron goddess, Athena. You see, Athens was burned to the ground in 480 BC by Xerxes Persians, the Xerxes of Esther fame, by the way, burned Athens to the ground. And as they rebuilt it during the golden age of Greece, they rebuilt the entire city to be a religious monument to the Greek goddess Athena, and then all the other gods of the Greek pantheon as well. Religion and politics, civil life, public life, and belief life were all interchangeable. The idea of a separation of church and state or church and religion for them was unthinkable. It was all together. So if you were part of the civic part of the city, you were a religious person. And Paul understands at their core that every person on the planet is religious, meaning they believe in something. If you want to start with that premise, you're off to a good start to engaging your world for the cause of Jesus Christ. I tell my students, as we have a discussion in my class, I say, you know what? Every single one of you in here is a believer. Now, I get some of the looks some of you are giving me. Some of you are smiling. Some of you don't look so happy with me right now. But they are. Every single one of them is a believer. I did not say every single one of them is a Christian. But every single one of them is a believer. Does Satan believe in God? Sure. Did demons identify Jesus as the Son of David in the Gospels? Oh, yeah. They believe. In fact, I'll take it a step further. I will tell you this. I don't tell my students this. This wouldn't go over real well with the administration. But I'll tell you this, that the cells and stalls of hell are populated with believers. Not Christians. Believers. There is a difference. And I tell my students, every single one of you is a believer. And so it's interesting, the reactions I get. The kids who have identified themselves as Christians to me say, well, I'm a believer, but that pagan over there, I'm pretty sure, I don't know, Andy, that's a pretty bold statement. And then the students who have identified themselves as atheists will say, well, you and the other Bible thumpers, I know you all are believers. I'm surely not. Oh, but you are. You cannot exist as a human being and not believe in something. And the human heart, as I understand it, as I have a biblical worldview, is endowed by our Creator with the image of the Creator. The fancy way of saying it is the Imago Dei, the image of God. Everyone has it. Every person on the planet is driven to see something as great and to worship it. Every person on the planet, no matter how irreligious they may appear or claim to be, and you may take that at face value, but please know, as Paul did, that every person worships something. It could be a person. And you all know that person that worships their spouse or significant other. Their children, their job, their wallet, their bank account, their idea, their team. Everyone worships something and puts their hope in something. Paul knew that. Not only did he understand everybody is religious, but he is distressed by the idolatry that he sees. He is greatly distressed, it says right there in verse 16, with the idolatry that he sees. He is not angry. He is not all upset. He's not walking around saying, you filthy pagan Athenians, how dare you? That's not his attitude. In fact, the word used here of Paul, as he says later on, he carefully investigates their objects of worship. would be the same word used of Jesus in Matthew chapter 9 when Matthew says that he's moving through the towns and villages preaching the good news of the kingdom, and he is greatly distressed to see that the people are helpless and harassed and like sheep without a shepherd. For those of you who have served in some kind of ministry capacity, whether as a pastor or a layperson, a deacon, whatever, but you have served God by serving people, you will know what this word means. If you can think about that time, you get that phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you look at your caller ID and you see it's a family member or a friend, and you know that not even they would be crazy enough to call you at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, "Hey, Pastor, how are you?" But you know they're calling. I worked in Scranton. Scranton, my friends, is the valley of the shadow of death. I don't know how many of you remember the show The Office, but it shows that sign, and it's real, on the Scranton Expressway. It says, "Welcome to Scranton." I've often thought about changing that to say, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." It is the valley of the shadow of death. And I have received as a pastor, when I was a pastor serving in inner city Scranton, I have seen more dead bodies in the hospital, and I've been in the room with more people that have passed away, and I've gotten that phone call. Our baby just died. Our house just burned down. She's gone. And when the phone rings and I see that, my heart sinks. Pastor Odell, do you know that feeling? You do. We don't like that. But we will endure it for the cause of Jesus Christ. That's what Paul feels. As he's looking around and he sees what's going on, his heart sinks at the vast lostness of an unreached people group. He understands and is distressed by the idolatry. You notice he doesn't go around and say, "This is not right. I can't believe you're trampling the rights of Christians. I can't believe you don't have legislation that protects them." Nope. He's just distressed. We probably could learn from that. And lastly, and we're going to subdivide this. Oh, hang on, maybe even buckle up. This is going to be different for you. Paul knew the thought culture of his world. One of my heroes is a man who passed away in 1984. His name is Francis Schaeffer. And I consider myself a Francis Schaeffer disciple, although he wore knickers. That's not going to happen. I'm never going to tuck my pants into my socks, to make a fashion statement. If it's necessary and I'm in a survival situation, I don't know what that might be, but maybe. But other than that, no. But Francis Schaeffer was brilliant. A man who wrote and ministered primarily in the 60s and 70s. If you were to read one of his books, and I think you might have one of them listed on your insert, The God Who Is There, I would highly recommend it. You would think it was written yesterday. But Francis Schaeffer, who was really interested in engaging young people, and particularly when the hippie movement was really taking off and the church ignored them, he said, "No way. We're going to engage the young people of the world and provide a safe haven for them to answer their questions." So he and his wife, Edith, developed a ministry called Labrie in Huemaz, Switzerland. They bought a chalet, and he said, "You come, you bring your questions, anything is fair game." And in one of his books that he wrote called Escape from Reason, he said that if we dare to engage, if the church really wants to stand at the crossroads of thought and culture, of reason and culture, where it should be, and engage its communities for the cause of Jesus Christ, we must not understand how they speak, the currency that they use, the food that they eat, and all those other things, but we also must understand how they think, their thought culture. And once we can do that, then we can start to speak truth into their lives. And I have taken that on as a personal mantra, and that has driven me. So Paul did some work to understand the thought culture. Now let's talk about a little bit of the history of the thought culture of Athens. Athens, by the time Paul gets there, is already an ancient city. It's ancient for us if this was its beginning, but it is not. It's already an ancient city. The golden age of Greece has come and gone. That passed 500 years, 400 or 500 years before the time of Paul. But it's interesting that he's doing some things in the city that have been done before. First, he goes to what he knows. He goes to the synagogue and speaks to the Jews there. So we do know that there is some presence of godliness in the form of Judaism. Maybe they had not heard the gospel yet. Maybe no one had told them the Messiah has come. I don't know. I don't know what they knew. But then it says that he talks to the God-fearing Greeks. And then it says that he goes to the marketplace. And whoever would be there, he discusses Jesus and the resurrection. Now, I had some folks at another church I was visiting sent me a lengthy email that told me that Paul failed in Athens because he failed to preach Jesus. I'm sorry, what translation are you reading? I don't think so. So he's preaching Jesus and the resurrection of the dead in the marketplace. Now, the Greek word for marketplace is agora. If you'd like to think about it like this, maybe this will help. That's the ancient equivalent to Walmart. Everybody has to go there eventually, whether you like it or not. And some of us, hey, I can buy a car battery and a shirt in the same store. Score. And go to Subway maybe even. In his case, it would be Gyroway, but that's different. So it's great. So he goes to the marketplace and he's discussing Jesus. Now, there's another guy who went to the marketplace and discussed great ideas. Do you know what his name was? Socrates. 400 years before the time of Paul. Now, Socrates did this, among other things, and got accused of corrupting the youth and was sentenced to death and was carried out by a jury of his peers. And I was raised in a culture that said that, well, corrupting the youth, that's probably the naughtiest place that you could take that idea. No, it really wasn't. Now, there are plenty of things about Greek culture that do not line up with biblical Christianity, rest assured. That was not the charge. The charge, does anybody know what the charge was? Why he was accused of corrupting the youth? Does anyone know? You can say it out loud. It's okay. They don't like me for doing this, do they? No. All right. So he was advocating foreign gods. Now, here's what Socrates was doing. You see, the Greeks, Socrates and philosophers, hundreds of years prior to him, were asking a question. They were looking at the universe, at what they could observe, human nature, and how they interacted with it, and they said, what is the center of all things? What holds it all together? So some philosophers thought it was water, some thought it was fire, some thought it was wind, some thought it was dirt. And you might think, well, those are all stupid. Okay, maybe. But if you were actually to read what they said, they actually had some cogent arguments about stuff. So, you know, fire consumes and kindles stuff and it goes up. Life is kind of like that. It's not terrible. I disagree with it. It's not terrible. But they all had a name for what they thought would hold the universe together. And they thought it was all different divergent things, but they all centered on one name. And that thing that they called it was this, the Logos, the Word. Wait, like John 1? Yeah, like John 1. So when John, writing, guess what, to a Greek audience, says, hey, y'all, I know who the Logos is. I know his name. It's not a thing. It's not an idea. He is a person. And FYI, he became one of us. Just saying. So Socrates, moving through the Agora, was asking questions, and he made a suggestion that got him sentenced to death. He said, you know what? This Logos, I don't think it's the pantheon of gods that we believe in. I don't think it's Zeus, Apollo, Athena, my favorite, Hephaestus. He makes armor. He's cool. And all these others. Please don't think I'm a heretic because I have a favorite Greek god. I don't really think he's real. It's like, you know, which Avenger do you like more? So he's going through the Agora and he's saying, I don't think it's any of these gods, but I think it is one god. I think the Logos is one. I do not know his name, and I do not know where he lives, but I think it is one. Now, I don't think personally Socrates is going to be present at the marriage supper of the Lamb. If he is, I have dibs on sitting next to him. I call it. I don't think he was there, but he was asking a really good question. Paul is doing the same thing, having this conversation with folks, and so Paul is classically trained. There are three cities that would make up the ancient Ivy League. One is Paul's home city of Tarsus. That was one of the centers of learning. The other, Athens. The third would be Alexandria, Egypt. If you say, well, wouldn't Rome be one of those? Not yet. It's coming, but they're not quite online yet. They're still working on their charter and getting their board of directors together to be one of the centers of learning. Not quite yet. But Paul understands a thought culture, and he runs into a couple different groups that Luke tells us about here. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers in verse 18 began to dispute with him, and some asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Now, the reason they're disputing with him is because Epicureans and Stoics, I'm going to explain this to you, what they are, had no concept of the resurrection of the dead. No concept. The Jews did. These guys and ladies did not. Now, remember when I told you that there are sometimes words that we say, that's old. That's old, dead, crusty, dead dude. Has nothing to do with me. They wore curtains, right? I don't need this. Let's move on. Okay, so this would be Epicureanism and Stoicism. Andy, you're the nerd. You deal with that. Well, let me invite you into my wonderful world of nerddom. This is important, and I want to explain this to you. So Epicureanism, they believed in a life that was free of pain. That sounds good to me. Does that sound good to you? I don't wake up in the morning, oh, I hope I hurt today. Yes! No. Some of us, you know that moment as you're just waking up and you think, oh, today is going to be the pain-free day. I'm serious. And then you move a little and then you're reminded of your mortality. Right? They wanted a life free of pain and a life that maximized pleasure. These were the dudes that came up with the idea, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So if you're thinking alongside of me, Andy, is this like the prototype of like the classic Roman party animal? Toga, toga. Yes. Yes, it is. Now, they didn't start off like this. These guys were merely asking a question that Christianity asks and answers. In fact, it is one of the three fundamental questions that philosophy asks. What is the good life? Who is a good person? They were honestly asking that question and doing their best to figure it out. Now, that curtain wearer that you see up there, that is a guy named Lucretius who wrote a book called On the Nature of Things about 100 years before the time of Christ. Probably Paul read it. In fact, I would bet money that he did, and I've read it too. And we get a lot of what we know about Epicureanism from this guy, and he says, listen, there are no gods, there is no problem. In fact, the Epicureans were known as atomists. They believed that all things were made up of tiny little particles. Now, they didn't understand atomic theory like we do in the modern age, but that's pretty amazing to think that thousands of years ago, a group of people thought that everything was merely made up of matter. And they're still with us today, those kind of people. But these guys said, if you actually believe in a God, it's dangerous. And if you don't believe in a God, you're really free. Same arguments that have been used for thousands of years. In fact, it was in Lucretius, he's addressing Hebrew people. In his book On the Nature of Things, he's like, hey, Jews, got a question for you. You would agree with me that there's evil in the world, right? Yeah, we would agree with that. You'd have to be really kind of not paying attention very well and say, no, the world, it's a happy place. There's nothing wrong with it at all. All right, please take me on the bus to that world. So he would say, yeah, you would agree with me that there's problems in the world. And your God, you say, is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-loving, right? Yeah. All right, so how do you reconcile those two things? So Lucretius would say, what's the problem? Does your God not know? Perhaps he's not all-knowing. He doesn't know there's wicked things that are happening in the world. Is that it? Or maybe he knows, but he's not powerful enough to stop it. Or maybe he knows and he's powerful enough to stop it, but he's really not as loving as you say. And he just doesn't care. Which is it? Now, you may or may not be surprised at that very same argument I read in a book that was published in 2009 called A Letter to a Christian Nation, written by atheist Sam Harris, who said the exact same thing. He didn't even give old Lucretius any credit. It kind of ticked me off. But it's an ancient argument. It's been around for a long time. So these guys said, no God, no problem, and basically you can live how you want. So let me give you the best example I can think of a modern-day Epicurean. That's Miley Cyrus. And that is of among the best, more appropriate pictures I could find to share with you this morning. Now, if you understand Miley Cyrus as being a person who is a believer, right? Does she have a belief system? Of course she does. She displays it, or perhaps a better word would be flaunts it. Are you filled with compassion for her? Like Paul was filled with compassion for the believers of Athens? Oh, the Epicureans are among us today. They're in my classroom. They work with you. They're your neighbors. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. We are nothing but dust. Or to show my age, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. All we are is dust in the wind, dude. It's a philosophy. And there are people who are living by, if you are nothing but dirt, you are free to do whatever you want. Stoicism. That curtain wearer, that's Marcus Aurelius, and he would post-date Paul by nearly 100 years. The closest thing that Rome ever had to a philosopher king. And these guys were a little bit different than the Epicureans. They actually believed in God, but their God was like a nebulous idea. It was reason itself. It wasn't a personal God with character. And so they said, I can figure this out. And they would say, we want a life that maximizes virtue. And there's actually a lot of overlap in Stoicism to Christianity. There's some agreement there. But they would say, you need to be ready. You can handle it. And a mind made everything. They believed in this cosmic mind. So you use yours. You could figure it out. So the basic difference is Epicureans looked at all the pleasure that they could take in from the outside, all the things that they could take in. The Stoics said, no, we're not going to take it in because we will develop our answer from within. We have the answer inside of us. It is within us. It is innate. It is everything about us. And we must only unlock it. And once we do, we can figure out life and be happy. And if you think that is an ancient dead philosophy that has nothing to do with 21st century America, you are sorely incorrect. In fact, let me give you probably our best known example of a Stoic right there. I did think about putting Yoda and Mr. Spock on the same slide, but I think the universe would unravel. You can't do that. You can't have, I don't know how to do that. So they are with us. And if you disagree with me, just go to a public school graduation the next time one rolls around and you listen to the speeches. They're full of stoicism. You decide your own destiny. You choose what is best. Do not let anyone tell you what you can or cannot do. Every public high school graduation. And they're all wrong. So Paul understood all that. He really understood his world. So now we're going to start moving fast, right? I know I'm nearly out of time. So the next thing that Paul does is that he takes opportunity. So they bring him, verse 19, they take him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus. Now the Areopagus is more of a group, not necessarily a place. I want you to think of it as the faculty lounge at the University of Athens. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting. Remember, they had no concept of the resurrection of the dead. You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Does that sound like a culture you know of? It's called Facebook. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious, for as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Now what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. Now it's getting good. Right? So these Epicureans and Stoics that Paul understands, they bring him to the Areopagus. The Areopagus is where you'd go to try out a new idea. I'm going to see how it stacks up with the other ideas. I'm going to see if it gets shot down or accepted, and I'm going to present my case in a logical way and see what is going to go on. So they bring Paul there because they want to see how it stands up. So Paul takes the opportunity to say, no, I don't belong here. I'm just a simple preacher. I'm just a missionary. I'm just a tent maker. No, Paul was amped up. He said, let's do it. Yeah, I'll go to the Areopagus. Sure, I've been to the synagogue. I've talked to the God-fearing Greeks, and I've gone to Walmart and Gyro Way. Now I want to give me a chance to go to the Areopagus. And he stands up, and he doesn't say, well, you're also religious, and you're trying so hard. Good for you. Oh, that's wonderful. You're religious people, and you enjoy getting together. But no, he doesn't do that. He says, men of Athens, I do see in every way you are very religious. You're all believers. In fact, I see that as I carefully investigated your objects of worship, I didn't ignore them. I didn't turn my face and say, oh, how awful. I looked at them and I studied them because I want to know who you are. I see that you even have a statue with an inscription to an unknown God. You're covering your bases. Well, what you have previously worshiped as unknown, I will declare to you. Boom. mild fireworks should be going off in your mind right now as you're thinking about this. So not only does he take opportunity, but then he speaks with authority. So let me just blaze through and sum up for you this final section. And I told you that I was going to do this. And I do recommend that you read it, but this is really familiar. So what Paul says is he begins at the beginning and he says, listen, the God of the universe, the one that you worship is unknown. He's not like your gods. Let me tell you how he's different. Your gods require that you have to build them a shed or a barn or a stable or a temple in which they're housed. The God of the universe, he doesn't need any of that. In fact, he doesn't need human hands to serve him at all. Paul references things like, you bring your drink and food offerings to your gods. In fact, Paul mentions, I believe it's in Philippians, that he's being poured out like a drink offering, right? That's the pagans did that too. They'd stand over the graves of their departed and they'd pour out booze on the grave. I'm really not sure why, but that's what they would do. And he'd say, so you bring drink and food to your gods and do they eat it? Well, they don't. So you have to come clear it up. Well, God of the universe doesn't need that either. He said, but the God of the universe has set a time and a place for all men to live, including you. And actually then Paul quotes a Greek rock star. And he says, just as your own poets say, in him we live and breathe and have everything. And your own poets say the same thing. And so he's explaining all this to them, that God doesn't need you to serve him, and he is from the beginning, and he's made everything, including the universe and you in it, and he has done all these things for a purpose, Athenians, so that you would seek him and find him, because he is not far off. Your gods, by implication, do not care if you seek after them. They only want you to bow down and serve and fall at their feet, but they don't want a relationship with you. The God of the universe who made you wants to know you and has made himself available so that you would seek and find him. And if you seek him, you will find him. And he said, by the way, if you want some evidence of this, it's because his son, Jesus Christ, whom I've been preaching, was crucified. He's not still in his grave. Go look. I have the name and address of where he was buried, in a tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. He doesn't say that, but I'm telling you this, and Paul knew that. You don't give the address for a direct lie that you're going to tell. You keep the details a little bit vague. Go look. He's not there. Seek him and you will find him. I tell my students all the time that philosophy simply means the love of wisdom. Phileo Sophia, the love of wisdom. And I tell them, if you love something, you're going to chase it, pursue it. And so I have a conversation with them about what are we going to pursue in this classroom? If we are going to become lovers of wisdom, what are we going to pursue? And they come up with some different answers, and sometimes I hit upon it. Sometimes I have to tell them, we are seeking after truth. You see, ladies and gentlemen, I am confident that if I can engage college students, an unreached people group who are steeped in the materialism of Epicureanism, who are steeped in the false notion that they can create their own happiness, Stoicism, and any other kind of school of thought that has a similarity or a hint of truth that would somehow agree with Christianity, that is at the end false, empty, and hopeless. I am convinced that the author of all truth, who allows me to stand before a group of students and we discuss truthful things, that if they honestly are loving wisdom and they seek truth, they will find him. And praise be to the God of the universe, some have. Now, the end of the story, and some people say that Paul failed here because only two people came to Jesus. Okay, well, let's talk about those only two people. First of all, one was a woman named Damaris. Now, I don't know how she heard what was going on in the Areopagus because she wasn't allowed in there. Don't be mad at me. I'm not saying anything. I'm just telling you the culture, right? She was not allowed in there, so she was listening at the door. But a member of the Areopagus, a man named Dionysius, gave his life to Jesus. Do you know what Dionysius went on to become? The Bishop of Athens. The first pastor of Athens. You can read this in the histories. You can read it by a guy named Eusebius, who in 300 AD wrote the first history of the church, and he tells us a lot about Dionysius and what he accomplished and the gospel ministry that took off after that. Ladies and gentlemen, we have sometimes not done a very good job of engaging our world and loving God with all of our mind, with all of our strength, with all of our soul, with all of our might, yes. But sometimes we haven't done a very good job of loving God with our mind. My battlefield, my battle space is the mind. The spoils of war are seeing those that Paul in 2 Corinthians 4:4 would describe as being blinded by the God of this age, that cannot see the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. The spoils of war are seeing captives set free and given ultimate freedom by the Son of God. Seeing that there is an answer beyond hopeless Epicureanism or Stoicism. And we discuss deep truths in the classroom, and they know who I am, and I'll tell you my story tonight and how this unfolds even further. But God has called me to engage university students and to encourage folks in churches just like this that they can have confidence in their faith and do some other things as well. So my challenge for you this morning is, how far are you willing to go to understand your world? Do you think God is calling us to ignore it and turn inward, or to engage it, to understand it and turn outward? And do we have the guts? Do we have the stamina? Do we have the wherewithal to actually carefully investigate the idols of today? Or are we so repulsed and disgusted by them, we can't even look? If we don't look and understand them, who will? And just like Paul dealt with people who had no understanding about who the God of the universe was or the resurrection of the dead, they're among us today. We live in a post-Christian culture who have no understanding at all. Where will you start? Where will you start? Perhaps we can ask God to help us just to think a little harder, do a little more homework to understand our world so that we can engage it with the life-changing truths of Jesus Christ. Amen? God, we thank you for this morning. I thank you for our time that we could spend here. God, I thank you for this church and for all that it represents. God, for the thousands of lives that have been that have come through here and have been touched. God, we love you and we thank you. We ask you that you continue to do so, and we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.